This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, keeping kids safe when they're online. But first, the U.S. Department of Labor announced its new overtime rule last month. It's expected to extend overtime to millions of salaried management, administrative, and professional employees. But Senate Republicans are trying to block the new rule before it goes into effect in December. Joining us to examine details of the new rule and how it could affect employers and employees, our director of the Economic Center at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Julie Heath, employee benefits specialist and partner with Strategic Employee Benefits Services, Jennifer Homer, and partner at Voorhees, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Angela Gibson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Julie, Jennifer, and Angela, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Angela, explain what is this new rule that's scheduled to go into effect in December? What does it say exactly?
All right. Well, the Fair Labor Standards Act generally governs all wage and hour issues, including overtime and minimum wage. And I think the main part of this rule is it's changing the salary level that employees have to meet in order to maintain their exempt status. So if an employee is exempt, they do not get overtime pay. Overtime, of course, being 1.5 times their regular hourly rate. So the change has gone from where the minimum salary level used to be $455 per week. Now is $913 per week. So that annualized, that goes from $23,660 in salary to $47,476. There's another exemption for highly compensated employees. That amount was $100,000, or currently is until this rule comes into effect, and that will increase to $134,004. Also, those numbers will continue to increase once every 3 years. They'll be automatically adjusted upwards. And there are some other finer points to some of these changes. For example, now as part of meeting that minimum weekly rate of $913 per week, you can include up to 10% of that amount in non-discretionary and incentive pay compensation. So commissions, for example, could be factored into that.
Why is that element important?
Well, when you've got commissioned salespeople, or I should say, if you've got anybody who's making commissions or getting incentive pay or a non-discretionary bonus, which generally would be something like an employee gets a certain amount of money if they hit a certain production goal, then the amount of 913 can go down by 10% so long as that 10% is made up through that bonus. Now, there are some other points to that. For example, if that bonus is not hit, there's some other catch-up pay provisions that would have to be factored into on a quarterly basis. But that's something that is new to this rule.
So, Jennifer, this is, I guess, roughly speaking, it's doubling what the old limit used to be.
Yes.
So it's going to go up to 913 was what Angela was saying?
Per week, yes. And that annual salary is $47,476, which is a pretty median salary for a lot of our organizations, clients, nonprofits, manufacturing number. So I think that's why it's such a big deal, is that probably almost all employers at least have to take a look at it. And I had read a number, it's going to impact 40% of a salaried workforce. And that's staggering, and I think that's why this topic has become so hot in probably all three of our worlds recently.
Julia, she's saying in the 40% range. Is that what you're saying too?
It's 4.2 million workers.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of folks. It's a lot of folks.
And who primarily is this going to affect in terms of what types of industries, what types of workers?
Well, in terms of what type of occupation, it's primarily going to affect office and administrative support. About 46% of office and administrative support personnel could be affected by this new rule. In terms of industries, we're looking at leisure and hospitality. So, fast food, retail, those kinds of individuals. So it's these mid-manager kind of positions that may have been working 50 hours a week now we're going to be capped at 40, mm-hmm. or you know, or get some kind of compensation for that.
Why did the Labor Department feel the need to make the change to this particular rule?
Well, I think that you know, President Obama issued a memorandum in March 2014, and generally, you know, the salary threshold was, you know, in his opinion and in the DOL's opinion, too low and not indexed to where it should be. And so mm-hmm. this increase ties it to where, at least for the regular exemptions, so that they're in the 40th percentile of full-time salaried wage earners. And then for the highly compensated exemption, that's going to tie them to the 90th percentile, which I think many believe is where it should have been all along. It's just it hasn't been adjusted appropriately.
Well, yeah, this is a way to target the middle class and to bolster the incomes of the middle class. I think it's important to note, though, that over the years, the workers that have been non-exempt has decreased. In 1975, almost half of the workforce was non-exempt, and now we're down to the latest number in 2015. It's less than a third. So it's just that cap, you know, that threshold just hasn't kept pace with inflation and, you know, other wage adjustments. But this is really nothing new, and in fact, that it's been eroding over time. It just hasn't been keeping pace.
So this new rule is just a way of catching up, then?
Yeah, it's a big catch up. But they also worked in that every 3 years kind of recalibration, so that we don't have another great big catch up like we're having this time.
I think there was a period of time too. I recall. So in our business, we have 25 employees. And I, you know, I reflect back, and I don't know exactly how many years ago it was, but there became the terminology of non-exempt salaried. So they would be folks that maybe by job description, if you were thinking about, okay, I'm going to go out and recruit and hire, would fall maybe in an exempt type category, but they were kind of just borderline. And so they were in that job description, but you still had to pay them overtime. Okay, so you hire them in at a salary, right, not an hourly rate. But because of the way they were categorized, we still had to pay overtime beyond that. And so I think that might have been kind of stair-stepping to get us to this point and kind of help some companies work towards it. But I know for, you know, putting my employer hat on, it's a pretty big deal. And we were talking, you know, before the show started, we're like, okay, we're almost to July 1st. And this has to be done by December. And you have to really take a step back, look at your workforce, you know, what their job classifications are, how you have them now. And then internally you have to make some movement, and that takes time, I think, from both just a mechanical standpoint and a morale standpoint. We just hired a new COO, and this became her first project, you know, just for our business. And then from a partner of our employers we work with, it's the hot topic. We revamped our seminar schedule this summer to get them on. We've had some webinars. You know, people are really trying to understand and learn about this and get out ahead of it.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And just to be clear, we're talking about exempt and non-exempt. Exempt means you're exempt from overtime, so that's how you look at it. Non-exempt means that you're eligible for overtime. Yeah. I always get those terms confused. So am I hitting that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So any for the non-exempt people, any time over 40 hours per week will be time and a half.
Now, Angela, can you explain about the duties test? Because I understand this new law just it doesn't affect the duties test. That remained intact.
That's correct. Yeah. And that's another big component of the exemptions generally. I mean, this law only affects, or for the most part, just changes the salary level. But in order to be exempt, you have to not only meet the salary level, you have to be paid on a salary basis. You also have to meet various duties. So it can't just be any job so long as that employee makes the threshold. There are three main exemptions. There are some other specific ones, specific to certain occupations like teachers, doctors, lawyers. But there's the executive exemption, administrative, and professional exemption. The executive is somebody whose their primary duty is management of the business. They have to be able to direct two or more people. They have to have authority to hire or fire, or some be able to make meaningful recommendations with those kinds of decisions. And so if they don't meet those duties, they're not going to be exempt regardless of how much they make. They're going to be entitled to overtime. And a lot of employers get tricked up on that. And they think, you know, well, this person makes a whole lot of money. Certainly, they're not going to be entitled to overtime. But they don't meet any of these duties. And so then when you go back and you have to factor, they get sued, or the Department of Labor comes after them, and you have to factor into how much is owed. Now you're looking at possibly somebody who made $80,000 a year, figure out their average hourly rate, which is very high, and then time and a half for anything over 40 hours. So it can be an astronomical number. Not to mention, you know, their attorney's fees and liquidated damages and all kinds of penalties involved with doing that. So there's that executive exemption. There's an administrative exemption. This is where the primary duty is performance of office or non-manual work directly related to general business operations. They have to exercise independent judgment in that. That role is some. Oftentimes, you might think of somebody in HR or somebody who's kind of tangential to the business, not the core of the business. And finally, there's the professional exemption, which is the primary duty requires knowledge of an advanced type in a field of science or learning, or it's their duty requires invention, imagination, something like an artist or, you know, architect or something to that effect.
So, Jennifer, it sounds like there are a lot of layers to this, just this one change.
Yeah, there are a lot of layers, and that's why, you know, like I said earlier, they have to really get out ahead of this, because that's part one.
And then what about the thought that this could be blocked? I mean, should you count on that?
I don't know. I mean, I think when Affordable Care Act came out, we kept doing the wait and see, thinking it was going to get blocked, and it didn't. You know, so I think you have to do some prep now to at least start thinking about it, because 6 months goes by so fast. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but.
Mm-hmm. From both the employer and the employee standpoint, I mean, one of four things is going to happen as a result of this. One is you're going to start getting paid overtime if you fall in that non-exempt category, or you'll get a raise to put you over that threshold, that new threshold, or you won't get any more money, but you'll be working your 40 hours. And so, and really, again, you know, that's the intent. Either people will get a little bit more money to put them over the threshold, or they'll have more free time. But the fourth is employers could choose to lower your base hourly. They could, in other words, transfer you from a salary to an hourly. And then you could still work the same hours, but if they reduce your base pay enough, you'll actually get paid the same or even less. From an employer standpoint, that's a very risk. I mean, that's bad for morale, right? So from an employer standpoint, that's a risky enterprise. But typically, non-exempt people get a different benefit package offered to them than exempt people do. It's less generous. So as employers are thinking about how do we react to this, you know, it's going to be a lot easier to construct something that makes sense going forward rather than what in the world do I do with all these people that are already on my payroll? I mean, like I said, if you're changing hourly rates and changing benefit packages, then you're probably going to be looking at a lot of turnover in terms of your workforce, and nobody wants that. That's inefficient. So, you know, what am I going to do? Am I going to give these people a little bit of raise so that we're out of that non-exempt category? Or, you know, do we actually curtail working time? And if we curtail working time, then do I need to hire other people to fill that work? If I have all these people and now they're only working 40 hours, then I may have work that's not getting done. Do I need to hire part-time people to do that? So it is possible that this could actually be a job stimulator.
Okay.
I don't think it's likely, but it's possible that people could actually be hired to fill in the gap that cap at 40 is going to create.
We will continue our conversation about the Department of Labor's new rule on overtime pay, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to examine details of the new rule on overtime and how it could affect employers and employees, our director of the Economic Center at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Julie Heath, employee benefits specialist and partner with Strategic Employee Benefits Services, Jennifer Homer, and partner at Voorhees, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Angela Gibson. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So if this does go into effect, and you've also got the Affordable Care Act along with this, as you were mentioning, Jennifer, what are there any estimated costs to businesses just to stay in compliance with all the record keeping and things that they're going to have to do? Julie, maybe you know some more about that too. No? Okay.
I don't have a cost, but I think from an overall compliance perspective, a lot of the new things Department of Labor have come out with, I think it's increased the cost within businesses, whether it's legal advice that they're having to gather, you know, document prep, time for CFOs and COOs. So I think it's just added a whole nother layer of complexity to what was already complicated with what they had to do. And I see that in any employee group size. I think we look at these things and we think, oh, that's probably for large employers upstream. Like I said earlier, I'm an office of 25, and it's been a pretty hot topic in my office.
It's been your COO's big job since she came in.
Yeah, we've got, you know, we've been holding seminars. We've been having webinars. And, you know, the one that we had 2 weeks ago, I was shocked at how many people jumped on it. We're like, oh, a couple people listened to it. So I think it's definitely the Department of Labor chatter for the summer and keeping all three of us pretty busy.
Mm-hmm. So. Angela, go ahead. Sorry, Julie.
Aside from the top tier management compliance concerns, is, you know, if you do have, if an employer does decide that, well, we're going to go the overtime route and we're going to pay time and a half, then you have all of the employee costs of keeping track of that time. You know, how is that going to be managed? Someone has to oversee that to make sure it's legitimate. So you have upper management and then the actual implementation costs of that as well.
Angela, are you getting a lot of questions about this change?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if anything, it's a good opportunity for all employers to just revisit their pay practices. I've had a lot of employers ask me, you know, what does this mean for our business? And quite frankly, it really, unless you've got truly exempt employees who fall somewhere, you know, under the 47,000 threshold, this isn't going to be that much of an impact to you. But it may be a good time to go back and revisit your job descriptions, you know, even under the current law. Are they really exempt? Do they meet those duties tests? And then if, for example, it is an employer who has some employees who might be affected by this due to their current pay, in deciding what to do, they do need to think about, you know, as everyone else mentioned, record keeping and keeping track of those employees. If they're going to decide to keep them hourly or make them hourly when they were previously a salaried exempt employee, you've got to watch what's called off-the-clock work. Are they, do they have access to their email from their cell phone? Are they doing emails from home at night? If so, how is that going to be tracked? Because all of that would be compensable pay. So it's not, you know, it's not just making the decision of whether to keep them, you know, to increase their pay, but there's some logistical issues and probably additional costs associated with software, whatever needs to be done to keep track of all of those hours and time spent working.
Angela, I think the Department of Labor had originally proposed that, when we were talking earlier about the salary level going up every 3 years, hadn't they originally proposed that to be an annual increase at first? And also, I think they also had the cap set a little higher too.
Yes.
It was around 51,000
or
so.
That's correct.
Why did they back away from those two things?
Well, I know with the annual increase that just would be a logistical nightmare for employers to deal with. I mean, if you have to reevaluate every single year, that would be a lot, obviously, and continue to change your, you know, the pay. And under the current rule, they give you, I think it's 150 days notice of what that new increase will be prior to the, you know, every third year when they make that increase. So I think annually there was a lot of pushback because that's just too much for employers to deal with.
And as far as the cap being a little bit higher and now being at 47,000, what was the thinking there? Do you?
I think that was just a compromise.
I'm sure they heard from a lot of people about this. 513-419-7100. Michelle in Northside joins us now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Hello.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering about exemptions for church musicians who we do require, I mean, we do have a higher level of training in certain areas, and who should my employers talk to about that?
Okay, I'm going to jump in on that one. That is going to be a very fact-intensive inquiry, as what most of these issues are. I mean, a lot of these wage and hour issues are complicated, and when you're looking at the various duties to see if this person could be an exempt person, I would suggest talking to an employment attorney to go through the details of what this person does, you know, what's their schedule like, and so on, to see if there's a strong argument for this person to be exempt.
You mentioned an exemption having to do with creative activity, mm-hmm. and certainly that does. It's my understanding that where I work, they're looking into an exemption for clergy, but they don't know if that's going to work out. But to me, it also would fit into that. Did I mishear mm-hmm. what you said before?
No, that you're correct. That is an exemption. In terms of whether this person would fall under that, though, there may be some additional, you know, details that we would want to know to say for certain. I mean, those are just the very basics to meet that exemption. There's always finer points to know for sure, you know, and oftentimes it's not a clear-cut answer. This one may be. I don't have the answer in front of me, but oftentimes it's a scale of risk. You know, how much risk are you comfortable taking? If the person is probably exempt, we may not know 100% for sure in all cases.
How do you know?
Yeah, I mean, in some cases it is it may be an example identified by the Department of Labor and some guidance. In other cases, there may be case law that has decided that a certain position with those particular, the way that person is paid and their hours and so on, qualifies as exempt. But, you know, it oftentimes takes a little bit of research.
Michelle, thank you for the call. We appreciate it very much.
Sure. Thank you.
So in these closing minute or two that we have here, what would be your advice, Jennifer, as far as you're saying, get on this fast, get on it early, don't wait. What other advice would you have for employers as far as preparing for this?
Well, I think just really, you know, taking a look at their job classifications, identifying who's exempt and non-exempt, you know, reviewing it. But I kind of agree with Angela. I think for even companies who won't be greatly impacted, it's just kind of a time to take a step back and kind of get your house in order, you know, because a lot of smaller employers, HR departments are doing several things, and they might have needed to look at this over the years, but nothing came to fruition to make them do it. So I think in our office, it just made us get our house in order, and I think that's my advice is the worst case thing happens if it doesn't go through is that you've identified your job descriptions, you've looked at your salaries, and you've taken care of some of those things that you might have needed to.
Which doesn't hurt anyhow. Julie, any final thoughts on this?
I think Jennifer's absolutely right. You know, salaried employees report much more work-life balance problems than hourly employees. So I think some of the additional consequences of this could be helping employers and employees alike take a look at that balance. You know, like I said, one of four things is going to happen. The fourth one was unlikely. So either you're going to get a raise, or you're going to get overtime pay, or you're going to work a 40-hour work week. And from an employee's perspective, that's not so bad. And so maybe this will bring employers and employees more to a common ground of let's look at this work-life balance issue and see if we can carve out something together. I mean, about 21% of Ohioans are going to be affected by this. So that's not an insignificant number of people.
And from your perspective, Julie, is there a chance the House GOP stops this from going through in December?
You got your
crystal ball out.
I am not going to predict anything in this election year. I think anything is possible, and we shouldn't be surprised at anything.
Well, Julie, Jennifer, and Angela, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Director of the Economic Center at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Julie Heath, Employee Benefits Specialist and Partner with Strategic Employee Benefit Services, Jennifer Homer, and Partner at Vorys, Sater, Seymour & Pease, Angela Gibson. Coming up, we'll take a look at teaching kids to protect their online reputations. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.